First of all, I'm George Raymond from Minneapolis. I work for Sperry Univac, which is the second largest computer company in the country, although you never read that in the papers, but that's, I think, a fact. And I work in the Defense Systems Division, which designs and builds computers for the government, mostly, but not exclusively. We build things for the Navy, we build computers for FAA, for the air traffic control, a variety of things. Mostly aimed at those applications that require something special in the way of performance or reliability or ability to withstand environmental conditions and so on. And the reason I thought it would be well to talk to you tonight is because I think we're on the verge of a major expansion of the computer business. You've all seen these little calculators. Well, those are computers. And the guts of a little calculator is a computer chip, a little chip of silicon, maybe an eighth of an inch square, on which are all the components that go to make up that computer. And these little calculators work just the same as these massive big computers you've all heard about. But now you can buy a computer for $10. They used to cost a million or more, several million. These little ones, of course, don't have the capability of the big ones, but they can have. And the implication is there that we're going to see computers everywhere in the next few years. For example, probably one of the big items in the toy departments at Christmas this year will be computer games that you can hook up to your television set. You've probably seen these Pong games around in arcades and bars and most any place. Those are run by a computer. There's a little computer inside there that decides, based on where you put the paddle, which way the ball will go. And it's just the beginning. The Amana microwave oven is controlled by a computer now. It's going to very shortly be probably used, these little computers will be used for controlling washing machines and dryers because it's cheaper to buy one of these little chips than it is to buy the timer mechanism that they use for controlling appliances at the present time. Automobiles will be run by computers in the sense of timing the spark, adjusting the mixture. All these things can be done far better and easier with computers. And all that's coming. Someone said I should have the talk be on computers in the future, and I guess my remark was, why talk about the future? The present isn't even here yet. We've got all these things that have been done, can be done, but they aren't really being done as extensively as they could. So that's why I say that the present hasn't really been expanded to cover our whole society yet in the computer business, but it's coming very fast. So it's time we knew something about it. Look on Holden Village as a place that's trying to export people out into the mainstream with some influence, some ideas that may have some influence on the mainstream of our society. You've got to know about the mainstream in order to do that. Maybe we should have more discussions like this about business and computers and other things that really control and govern our mainstream of our life. So, the reason for the talk. One of the problems we have, I think, is the fear and awe in which people hold computers. We want to reduce that. There's nothing to be feared in a computer. You shouldn't hold them in awe. They're pretty stupid, simple-minded machines, really. We've got to get rid of the superstitious attitude that we have toward them. Realize that the computers are our servants, not the masters. How many of you saw 2001, the Space Odyssey 2001? You remember the computer there that sort of took over toward the end? Name was HAL. Remember HAL, the computer? I wrote the alphabet on the board here. Show you something if you haven't heard it already. There's A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q. Here's HAL. You notice what's right next to him? Just shift over one letter.
IBM.
Don't worry about HAL. Worry about the people that control the computers. Don't worry about the computers.
George?
Yeah?
Did you write that alphabet
I just wrote it in a way which made it easy to show that by shifting the letters one letter down in sequence, you change HAL into IBM.
I was just going to say, it looks kind of like a well-ordered way of showing us, you know, like a computered way of...
I want to talk a little bit...
That's not a criticism, but that's kind of neat that... are we able to talk
I want to talk a little bit about codes, and this is a way of writing codes, you know, shifting letters and putting numbers for letters, and I want to talk a little bit about that. I want to try and give you some insight into how a computer works. Now, that's pretty difficult in 10 minutes or whatever I'm going to spend on it. But another thing that I want to be sure we get across is to make you aware of what some of the things people can do to affect your life using computers. As I said before, don't worry about the computers, worry about the people that are running them. Computers only do what people tell them to. So I'll try and give you some insight into what needs to be done to regulate computers and maybe show you a little bit of, give you a little faith in the fact that computers can do some great things to make life better if we watch it and use them properly. So what is a computer? And I guess we have to start out here with the idea that it's just a machine. It's a machine that processes data. Now, you or I can process data. We can sort, take a bunch of cards, you know, and write names on them and sort the cards alphabetically and manipulate them any way we please. And that's what a computer does. It just manipulates data, sorts it, categorizes it. You're dealing with data. This can be numbers or letters or whatever. It can also do mathematical calculations, but we can forget about that tonight because that, I don't think, is the important thing with computers. We shouldn't call them computers in the sense I'm going to talk about them. They're data processing machines. They work electrically, so we have to figure some way of converting this data, which is written down on a piece of paper or stored in someone's head. You have to figure out some way to convert it to electrical pulses because we can do great things with electrical pulses very fast, very quickly. Okay, everyone's had an electrical shock, I'm sure, sometime or another. And you know, you really notice that, you get a shock. And you can tell the difference between a shock and a no shock. If there's no, you put your finger on a wire and you get a shock, you know that. If you put it on the wire and you don't get a shock, you know that. So let's deal with that, the presence and absence of an electrical signal. And then we take a number zero, we say, well, let that be represented by no shock, and the number one by one shock, and the number two by two shocks, and then the number three by, in fact, let's go back, I got ahead of myself. Instead of having two be two shocks, let's have two be no shock followed by one shock. Call that a zero and a one, and then three would become two shocks in rapid succession. The only point I want to get across is you can convert numbers into electrical signals, and you can do the same thing with letters and anything that you can put down in numbers and letters. I guess with numbers and letters we can put down anything. So this is what we're going to do. I'm sure you've all seen teletype machines. You hit a key, hit the A key, and the teletype prints an A. It does that by converting the A into five pulses. They're either electric pulse or no pulse, pulse or no pulse. There are five of them. It takes five to represent the alphabet, five pulses. So in computers, they've recently now kind of standardized on eight pulses. They call it a byte. And with eight pulses, you can represent 128 different things. So that takes care of upper and lower case letters, all the numbers, all of the commonly used punctuation marks, and so on. So we're going to convert all of this information into eight pulses, and then those eight pulses will be used in place of the data that was originally written down on a piece of paper. First thing we have to do then, someone's got to take the piece of paper and convert what's on there into these pulses, and that's done by a person sitting down at a keyboard and typing, and out of the keyboard comes electrical pulses representing the information, which goes onto a magnetic tape to be stored, or into a punch card as holes to be stored, or something else. Many different ways of storing data. So what do we need for a processor then, a data processing system? We've got to have a way to input the data. I just mentioned that as being a person typing on a keyboard. A way to output the data. This can be a teletype, an electric typewriter, a high-speed printer, one of these displays you've all seen, oscilloscope display. We've got to have a place to store the information while it's being operated on in the processor, or while you're not using it. You've got to have it there so you can get at it when you want it. So we need a store of some sort. And then we need something to do the processing, the sorting, the adding, the subtracting. And I guess that's all you really need. You need something that can add, subtract, and decide, make a decision, compare. I mean, compare this number to a standard and either accept or reject on the basis of a comparison. So something that can add, subtract, and compare can do all the processing that's needed, because by subtracting you can divide. You just keep subtracting the same number as many times as you want to divide and you get an answer. You can multiply by adding, and that takes care of all the calculations we need to do. And the comparing can be used to do just about everything else we want to do in the way of sorting. But then the most important thing we need is a person to tell this data processor what to do. And again, we come back to the thing that the computer is not so important as the person that's operating it. I think most of you have used these little electronic calculators. And to relate what I've just said in that sense, when you want to add two numbers together, you hit the keys for the first number. That's the input of the first number, and it goes into the memory of that little calculator. And then you tell the calculator what you want it to do. That's, in effect, programming it. You hit the plus sign. Then you put the second number in, you're inputting again. So you've got the first number, you have told it you want it to add, you gave it the second number, and it does it. It adds the two together, and it gives you the result. And the little display that you see is the output. The first number had to be stored in there somewhere while you put in the second number and the instruction. The instruction is the program. And I thought, try to think of some analogy we could use here at Holden. And I thought of the post office. That's probably the data processing machine here that we're most concerned with is the post office. So the boat comes in and someone brings the mail sack up and inputs it into our machine, the post office. And the processor in there takes the stuff out of the mail sack. So we had the mail sack going in, that's the input. We've got a window there for the output to go out. And we've got a bunch of pigeonholes labeled with the letters for the storage. And then we have a person in there to do the processing. Well, that's a very sophisticated data processing machine. No computer on earth is anywhere near as capable as a person in this field. So the person takes the mail out of the bag and looks at the first letter of the last name of each addressee and puts it in the right box. If you're going to do that with a computer, the computer could, well, it couldn't read handwriting. Computers can't read handwriting yet, so you'd have to convert it to some stylistic symbol that the computer could read. The computer would look at it and you say, is it A? The computer looks and says, yes. Okay, then it goes in the A box. Is it not A? I mean, if it's not A, if the answer is no, then the computer doesn't look and say it's an X, we'll put it in the X box. The computer just waits for you to say, is it a B? If the answer is yes, it goes in the B box. You go through the alphabet that way with each letter. Now a person looks at it and says, it is a C, I'll put it in the C box. You don't diddle around with all the other 25 letters of the alphabet. Then someone comes to the window and says, my name is so-and-so, do you have any mail for me? Person goes to that box, pulls out the stack of letters, sorts through, and sees if there's any mail for that person. A very simple operation for a person, but an operation with many, many, many steps if done by a computer. because the computer has to look first at the first letter of the last name, then at the second letter of the last name, and then at the third letter of the last name in sequence to find out whether that last name corresponds to the last name of the person spoke in the window. And of course, the computer couldn't understand the spoken word either, so that's another problem. So we have their input is the door through which the mail sack goes, the output is the window that people take the mail out of, the storage is the pigeonholes in which the mail is stored, and the processor is the person, and we have a very sophisticated processor. The customer is the user, and the programmer is the person who trains every new mail person that goes into that post office to run it. Tells the person what to do when the mail sack comes in the door. And it can be a fairly general instruction with a person, but with a computer, each and every step has to be detailed exactly. Computers can't read handwriting. Computers can't listen to the spoken word and understand it very well. We have a group in our plant in Minneapolis, some very highly trained fellows that have been working for 8 years now on making computers understand the spoken word, speech understanding they call it. And they have now gotten to the point where they can understand a vocabulary of 100 words or so spoken by just about anyone. But the clue to the difficulty of this problem is the fact that you speak the word into the microphone and the computer grinds away for 10 or 15 minutes and then prints out a list and says, these are the words that most probably were spoken, starting in order of the highest probability. And they're probably about 95% right with a single word. This gives you a little feeling for the complexity of the human brain and the capability of the human brain that we haven't even begun to reach in computers yet. When you hear a spoken word, your brain does a tremendous amount of computation and analyzing. And a lot of it is done not in listening to that single word that you hear, but rather in listening to all the words that are being said and sort of putting them all in context. And if you miss one, it doesn't make any difference because in the context you can probably replace one word or maybe two words. In fact, if you take a single word out of a conversation and record it and then play that single word back, very often it's completely unintelligible. You only can hear the word in the context of what was being said. You can't hear it when it's taken out of context. So your mind does all that processing very easily, but to do it with a computer is very, very difficult. And I'm sure it will be many years before computers will be able to respond to spoken words. Now, that's not to say they can't today, because given proper constraints, they can, and you can buy machines which can be hooked up to a computer and it'll listen to an individual, which that machine has been adapted to, speak certain very stylized words, and that computer can respond to it. So you can call numbers into a computer and it will understand if it's spoken by the right person. But someday, probably, we'll be able to speak to a computer in our normal conversational tones and have it respond. It's not here yet. Well, with all of this talk about how stupid or simple-minded a computer is, what's so great about them? And the thing that's great about them, first of all, is their incredible speed. This sorting that I've talked about, the mail sorting, for example, if you wanted to sort through a list of names, you can go through 10 million names in a second. Like that. You know, the whole population of the United States in a few seconds. Or a few minutes, the most. And that's what makes the computer so powerful. Another thing is the storage capacity, and this memory or storage place you have in the computer. There are computer systems in operation today that could store a whole library. 1,000 Encyclopedia Britannicas could be stored and ready for instant reference. If you know how to get in there to get at it now, you see. Again, you get the same thing. You want something that's down in the M's somewhere in the encyclopedia. The computer's going to start out with A, and it's going to see, is this letter an M? No, it's an A. Is this letter an M? No. By the time it gets through the first 500 encyclopedias to get down to the M's, a long time has gone by. So there are a lot of tricks that have to be played in storing information in the computers to make it accessible. But it can be stored, and it can be gotten out, and a tremendous amount of information can be stored in a single system. Another thing about computers is they don't make mistakes. Now, Molly's going to snicker at this because she knows my business is reliability. I'm a specialist in computer reliability. That's what I've spent the last 15 or 20 years at, trying to make the computers so that they are as reliable as they need to be. But I can say that computers are perfectly reliable if they're properly used, because you can build in checks and balances in the programming to make them perfectly reliable. And people are not very reliable. So there's another advantage computers have over people. People generally are about 98% reliable. If you give a person a task to do, and the chances are she will, or he or she will make a mistake 2% of the time. And this was brought out by the quit laughing, Molly.
I'm sorry.
This was brought out by the fellow that wrote an article explaining this, talking about how people make errors 2% of the time, and the article had 2% typographical errors in it. So it's true. People make errors, and you know that that's true, especially when they're given very routine jobs to do. Computers don't make mistakes if they're properly used. They sometimes break, they sometimes fail, the fuses blow, things like that. But computers don't make mistakes, and so the next time someone tells you you didn't get your paycheck because the computer goofed, don't believe them. Computer didn't goof, some person goofed somewhere. And that's why in our organization in St. Paul, paychecks are due out on Friday, and if someone doesn't get a paycheck on Friday, they have it fixed so that someone writes him a paycheck on the typewriter if necessary, and someone signs the paycheck so that he gets his paycheck that day. And we don't talk about the computer made a mistake. Somebody made a mistake there somewhere, and the guy didn't get his paycheck. And so we've set up a system to take care of that eventuality. And that's what needs to be done every time you use a computer. You have to consider what can go wrong and set up some system to take care of that. Okay, computers are very fast. They have huge storage capacities. They're very reliable. What aren't they? First of all, they have to be told exactly what to do. They do precisely what you tell them to do. Not what you meant to tell them to do, but what you told them to do. Very important. If what you told them to do is stupid, they'll do it just like you said, right to the letter. They have no judgment. And nonsense data is just as acceptable to a computer as real good data. So you have to be sure that the data you're using is good. You have to take precautions that the data you use is good, because the computer will process it whether it's good or bad, and the answer will be good or bad as a result. So we were walking up to Copper Basin this morning, and I think Dave or John, someone mentioned this little slogan in the computer business, garbage in, garbage out. And that's important to remember. You get in, you get out what you put in. If you put in garbage, you get garbage out. Can't emphasize that enough. That when you go to make a decision based on a computer output, or someone tells you a computer has done thus and so, made this decision, be sure you evaluate the data that was used in the input to that computer. The whole decision rests on what was put in. There's some other subtle things a computer can't do that people can do. And if a computer could be developed that would do some of these things, it would be fantastic. For example, how many people do you know well enough that you would recognize them when you saw their face? I'm sure you think about all the people you knew in grade school, all the people you knew in high school, you remember most of them. If you saw them again, you'd probably recognize them. The people you knew in college here at Holden, add it all up. I'll bet almost anyone knows 1,000 people. And when you see one of those people, you see their face and you know their name instantly. Now, how do you do that? You know, you can imagine sorting through a file of 1,000 pictures. That's what a computer would have to do. And you could find eventually the picture of that person and know that that was the person you just saw. But there is no way that you can sort through 1,000 pictures in the fraction of a second it takes you to recognize a person. And you can recognize a person if you see him from the front, full face, or profile, or from the back, most of the time from the back. That just can't be done with a computer. The computer has just one way. Look at this picture, is that the one? Look at that picture, is that the one? Look at that picture, is that the one? Go through the whole pile till it comes to the one that matches. And it has to match bit for bit, spot for spot. And so if you turn the face a little bit, none of them will fit. So in the human brain, there is this associative memory, the idea that you can instantly look through your entire memory and pick out one thing and recognize it, that there's been no computer system built today that has anything like that capability. And it isn't that people haven't tried. They've been trying in the 20 years I've been there. They've been trying, but no way yet. Speech recognition, I already talked about that. Very difficult problem. Another example is the sonar that's used in finding submarines under the water for purposes of defense or whatever. We have sonar on all our ships, and the data is processed through computers. And if you're lucky, if there's something out there, you might know there's something out there. It's not a certainty at all. And yet the porpoise can be trained to differentiate between a disc the size of a donut and a donut shaped, or a disc with a hole in it, thrown into the water, even though the porpoise can't see. And it works the same way. The porpoise sends out a sonar signal, gets the echo back, but the porpoise has a tremendous brain, larger, much larger than the human brain, for the purpose of processing this sonar information, and it can detect the gradations in the response from this echo coming back to the point of being able to differentiate between a disc without a hole in it and a disc with a hole in it. Our best sonar probably couldn't even see the disc, much less anything about it. So again, computers are nothing compared to the human brain. And the other thing that computers don't have is any intuition or creativity. There was a pretty good book here I found in the library, Man and the Computer, by John Kemeny from Dartmouth College. It's some lectures that he gave in 1971, so it's a little old. This is the problem with the computer business. You don't read books because they're all out of date. You have to read the magazines, and there are so many magazines, it's hard to keep up with them. But generally, this is a very good book, although he spends quite a bit of time talking about time-sharing systems where you have many people using one computer, and these little miniature computers I've told you about are kind of putting that out of date. So he's 5 years ago, he didn't know about those little calculators yet. So he's working on the idea that we should make it possible for many people to use one computer. You don't need to do that anymore. Everybody can have their own. But he talked about in here the fact that a computer can go through 1,000,000 alternatives while a person is going through 10. But the person quite often comes up with the right answer and the computer doesn't, because of this intuition and creativity bit. There's so many things that your mind can perceive that you can't transmit into a computer for a decision. So the brain, again, is far more powerful than the best computers. But where you need speed, storage capacity, and accuracy, you can't beat a computer. Someone said, I read somewhere, that all the computers in the world, all the computers built to date in the world, are not the equal of one human brain. in computing capacity. Now about this business of computers and people. What do computers do to us that's good or bad? And rather, again, we should say, what do people do to us using computers that's good or bad? First of all, virtually all the billing that's done in the world today is done using computers. Your credit cards, your utility bills, your department stores, and the credit bureaus that serve all of these people. Now just imagine here is a credit bureau with information feeding in from all the department stores in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and all the credit card companies in Minneapolis and St. Paul, and the credit card companies are mostly nationwide, so they have all the people in the whole United States tied in there. Think of the information you put down on the credit application when you apply for credit, and then imagine that that could be made completely available on all the people in the whole United States through the medium of computers, instantly available. That's the privacy issue that people are talking about, and that's why last year in Minnesota, the legislature passed a privacy bill to greatly restrict the use of computers by state government, or all the governments in the state, county, city, and so on. The minute you get all this information stored in a computer, the possibilities for information exchange for whatever purpose are tremendous. So we have to watch that very carefully. Mailing lists is another thing. The telephone book comes out, somebody puts an operator down on the key punch board and they key punch the telephone directory into a computer. Then you can immediately sort your mailing list by street address, by telephone number. The telephone exchanges generally run by location, so you can pick areas of the city, get all the people in a given area of the city by telephone number or street address. Having the street addresses, you can relate it to the zip code because the zip code directory relates to street addresses. So you very quickly and with a very low cost put together a mailing list of everybody in the phone book, everybody on the subscription list for a magazine of any kind, everybody that deals with a mail order house for any purpose. And so it goes. All of that information, once gotten into a computer, can be manipulated, sorted, compiled in any way. For example, the mail order catalogs. Sears Roebuck decides to mail out their catalog. They decide how many they're going to print. Now, who should they send them to? They don't send them to everyone. If you notice, if you don't buy something from Sears for a little while, you quit getting the catalogs. Well, they sit down for every catalog and decide, who are we going to send this to? The best customer is the most recent customer. The second best customer is the one that bought something a few months ago, but it was an expensive item like a refrigerator or a lawnmower, something fairly expensive. So they set up a criteria. Who's going to get a catalog? They just run all their lists through the catalog, and you see, every time you buy something from Sears, they make a little mark beside your name. They record how much you bought and what date. That's recorded for every purchase you buy from Sears through the mail order. So they can regulate the distribution of their catalog to get the maximum effect. Insurance policies. Something you may or may not know is that the insurance companies operate a computer center in Boston or somewhere around there into which all the medical records of all the people who apply for insurance from any insurance company are processed. Now, the insurance companies justify this on the basis that if a person is turned down for insurance by one company, they shouldn't be given insurance by another company. So they keep all the records together in one place. And I guess you can see the justification for it. They're interested in preserving their insurance system so it isn't corrupted. But there again, there's all of this information on all these people stored in one place with the possibility of some kind of use being made of it that's not proper. Some of the good things, reservations. You can get reservations in any hotel in the country. You can get a rent-a-car reserved anywhere in the country because they all have their information stored in a computer. Every hotel room in the country is tucked away in a computer somewhere, and if you want to reserve that room, they can take care of it for you from most any hotel. Same way with the airlines. Now, what this has given the airlines the ability to do is to, they find that generally 10% of the people never show up for a flight, so they automatically sell 10% more tickets than there are seats on the airplane. And they know that because of the fact that all these things are handled by computers, and they can get a report that shows for every flight how many people didn't show up. And I guess you can't argue with the system. It would cost a lot more to fly if they had 10% fewer people flying on each airplane. So it's a justified system. But it creates an inconvenience when you show up for the airplane and there's no seat for you, even though you had a reservation. So that's something that happens. Some of the other aspects of computers that are totally different from what I've been talking about: inventory control, stock records, anything that involves some kind of activity and items moving around. An ideal situation for a computer, and you can do an excellent job of inventory control. And if you deal with discount houses, you'll notice that they don't carry everything on the shelf that maybe the corner drugstore used to carry. They only carry certain items. The chances are they've got the one you want, though, because they carry the ones that sell the best. And they very quickly take out of their stock any item that is below a certain level of sales. And this has some implications in the fact that unless a company introducing a new item has sufficient resources to advertise it adequately in order that the demand in the public will be great enough to get it up above this minimum level where a discount house will handle it, that little producer is going to go out of business. He can't sell that item unless he can get a certain share of the market. So we're kind of legislating, with the use of computers in this way, we're kind of legislating bigness into the suppliers of goods to our stores. I've totally eliminated the talk about scientific calculations, but this is an essential part of the use of computers, and I guess I'll just ignore it tonight. They are used in all kinds of scientific research, probably in most cases to good advantage. And another place they're used that you probably don't know about is in telephone exchanges. All of the new telephone exchanges are computer operated, and they can do fantastic things for just a few cents a month more, each feature, just a few cents a month more. For example, if you're in one of these new electronic switching system exchanges and you're going over to your neighbors for the evening, if you have arranged for this service, you can dial a certain code into the telephone, dial your neighbor's number in there, and all the telephone calls coming into your home phone will be referred to your neighbor's. So the neighbor's phone will ring instead of yours. If a telephone call comes in and your line is busy, you're talking to someone else, this electronic switching system will somehow notify the person that's calling of that fact, and then when you hang up your phone, the computer will ring both telephones, the person that was calling you and yourself. Then you can both talk to each other. But each of those little features costs a little extra. So the issues I've been talking about: privacy. These big computer systems give whatever agency has them an unfair advantage over the individual, I think. The unfair advantage is what is really needed in this competitive world we're in. Everyone's looking for that unfair advantage over someone else. But I don't think we should allow big organizations to gain this unfair advantage over the individual. So we need laws regulating computers, privacy, so on. Merchandising, I guess the issue, and it's a personal thing I feel, I have never read anything about this anywhere, never heard it criticized as a defect, but I think in merchandising, the computers are legislating the fact that only bigness has a chance to succeed anymore. Insurance, if you get the wrong data into that medical file, you'll never get any insurance. It may take you a while to find out why. Reservations, this fact that you sometimes don't have a reservation when you thought you had one. In research, the issue there is the Are we going to research everything, or are we going to set some limits? I see there's a thing on the bulletin board in the dining hall about research and some of this genetic research that's going on, which could develop new species or new bacteria, which could be devastating to the world. I guess we've come to the point finally where we have to regulate the research. So that's something that should be thought about. And another issue I didn't really talk about is mathematical models. And there's a little bit in here. We use computers a lot for planning highways, for example, because the big problem when you're building a highway is you got to dig the dirt out of the high spots to fill in the low spots. And you want to dig as little dirt as possible. And it's pretty hard to figure out just what level to make the highway to get the best deal. Well, with a computer, you can compute all the possible levels, 2 or 3 million of them in a few seconds. So it's an easy job for a computer to develop the grade of a highway. Well, then you extend that a little bit and you say, well, where should we put the highway? And you build a model of which is the best place for the highway to be located. And a computer tells you the highway should go right through this low-income housing or a ghetto or something like that. And the example that's given in here is just that. City of Los Angeles, there was an open hearing. A number of voters complained bitterly that the freeway would go right through the midst of a part of the city heavily populated by blacks and would destroy the spirit of community that they had slowly and painfully put up. The voters' arguments were defeated by the simple statement that according to an excellent computer, the proposed route was the best possible one. That wasn't in accordance to any existing or excellent computer. It was based on the model that some guy devised into which he put the values that he was going to place on all these different factors, and he didn't place any value on the community. And so the computer ignored the community and went right through there in the model. So when you're dealing with something that has been planned or decided in a computer, you should evaluate the model that was used and the person that designed the model that was used in analyzing the situation. It's the model maker that's deciding what is going to be done, not the computer. And then while I was writing this down, I suddenly thought about cable television. And I realized that you should get Molly to have another session on cable television. It's another area of her knowledge she could talk about. Because what we're doing in these areas that have cable television is we're putting a high-frequency communication channel into every home. And all it is a wire, a coaxial cable, which can carry television or anything, and it's just wire. It works in either direction. You know, we're using it to get the television into the home, but can just as well be used in the other direction to take information out of the home. Something that should be considered. Not that it's bad, but that it has tremendous potential for good. That's the thing.
That's their big thing.
Don't worry about the surveillance. You can control that and put a piece of tape over the camera or something. But there's tremendous potential for good in cable television. Get Molly to talk to you.
You just devastated it before you said that.
What?
By the talk of the wire going both ways.
Well.
We have a debate here.
You get 3 minutes.
Yeah. In using computers, the issue is not what is possible, but rather what's acceptable to society, and that's what we have to control. We need laws to regulate it. California and Minnesota are, I think, ahead of everybody else in this privacy business. It's a very sticky subject because, well, for example, I was at work one day and I was talking to the girl in the personnel who runs the personnel records area, and I noticed they had a display, one of these Uniscope displays with a keyboard and a little screen there. And I said, hey, what do you use that for? I hadn't heard about it. Well, she said, oh, hey, come on in, we'll show you. And so she said, what's your clock number? That's the number that we're all identified by, and mine is 3429, and my name is Raymond. So she hit some keys, and bing, up on the screen comes George Raymond and all the data on me. But there's Dave Raymond. Well, he's my son. He doesn't even work there anymore, but he used to be a janitor. And there's David's information. And I suspect with a little tinkering we could have found Alan and Rick, and they all worked there too at one time or another. But you see, we weren't looking for David's information. She was just demonstrating the fact that my name was in there, and up came my son's name. And that's the way it is with these data banks. There's just a tremendous amount of information in there, and you can get one thing just as easy as the other. So we need laws to regulate them. It might be wise to start asking questions when the form you're filling out requires your social security number. They did a funny thing in Minneapolis, maybe Minnesota, but they got a new voters registration law there, so you can go into the polls and register today and vote today. You don't have to previously be registered. And somebody put on the form you had to fill out your social security number. And a lot of people got very upset. What has my social security number got to do with voting? And they were right. And then very quickly, right that day, while the polls were open, they had to change the rule and say you don't have to fill out your social security number. They had to call all the polling places and tell the election clerks to quit asking people for their social security number.
Because that would destroy the secret ballot.
Could.
Yeah, because it could.
And why they had it on there was, I guess, just for identification. So they had to identify the people that were coming in to register so that they wouldn't have someone registering six different places. And you notice insurance companies always ask for your social security number. Banks have to, because they're required to report to Internal Revenue what interest they pay you, so on. So, question when a form requires your social security number. Question when someone says a computer made a choice or a decision or a mistake. Question when something is blamed on a computer. Remember that computers don't make mistakes, but people do. And that shakes up people when you tell them that. They say, well, a computer goofed. Garbage in, garbage out, remember that. Models are made by computers, not people. Or models are made by people, not computers. Computers are simple-minded, stupid machines. Faster than a speeding bullet, though. You could, today, very possibly build a machine which could track a speeding bullet from a rifle and point another rifle and shoot that bullet right out of the air, like that. It's possible. That's how fast computers are. That's what you're doing, you know, with this anti-ballistic missile system. That's what you have to do. You wait for the ballistic missile that's coming at you to get down close enough so you can be sure it's a missile, and then you shoot something at it and knock it out of the sky before it hits you. Faster than a speeding bullet, accuracy or reliability beyond question, properly used, and a memory that never forgets. So that's it, computers. Any questions?
Well, I just want to emphasize that question bit, because I worked at a data processing, administrative data processing, which uses computers, and people don't realize that anything they put down on a form, they are putting into a computer memory. And so I asked one of our program, you know, project managers, I said, what is our protection from that? Because it can be used wrong. And it is used wrongly, even now, I imagine. I mean, I can very well see it being used to discriminate against certain classes in, like welfare people or people who have been in prison or, you know, something of that sort. In our society, that tends to all the system to discriminate against those types. So I asked him what the protection was, and he says, the only protection you have against computers yourself. And I said, how? And he says, don't put anything down on the form. And he says, no one can coerce you to write anything down on the form if you don't want to put it there. So if there's a form that asks for your social security number and you can't see the reason for it, or a form that asks what's your husband's name or what's your husband's business or any kind of address when it doesn't need it, you just shouldn't answer it. And he says, that's it. Right now, that's the only protection we have is your refusal to put in information. And the problem that can happen in this is that you put it in and then you've lost it, because frequently when you try to find out the record, one guy that was working where we did wanted to buy a house, and he had to go to a terrible lot of trouble to find out his record. And lo and behold, there were errors in his record, which were preventing him from buying a house. And he had to get that straightened up, and he did get it straightened up. But if you're under the regulations, as sometimes a welfare person is, or a powerless person, and they go to the bureaucratic desk and they ask, and they're just not going to get the answer out of the computer. They don't have the clout to ask for it, and so they can't tell. So they're kind of at the mercy of what might possibly be an erroneous record on them. So we do have to worry about it. I just, confirm what he's saying, question what they're doing with your information.
I suppose even like, I just went to the county fair, and at a dozen different places you sign up for a free gift.
Mm-hmm. Mailing list development.
You're on a dozen different mailing lists today.
That's a mailing list development.
But you get lots of junk mail.
You can imagine what might have happened. I mean, or could happen if we got a wrong government in. With all of these. If anyone began asking you where you went to church or what organizations you belonged to, and then somebody negative to that happened to gain power, I mean, we leave ourselves wide open for this.
There was a tremendous potential of computers neutral. It all depends upon.
And what use is made of it, and how they protect the biggest worry about computer divisions in anything is the security of their data. They have a terrible time trying to figure out codes and key people in this authority. They have to have a big system of who's allowed to retrieve information. And you didn't say anything about people walking in and destroying the information either, but they're walking through the tape rooms with a magnet or something.
Well, I think that's pretty well taken care of, but that's something you have to think about. If you're running a computer center, you must maintain a duplicate set of records in some other location, mm-hmm. protected from disaster. Because
has that happened?
Oh, sure. Well, I don't know if it was at our place, someplace. One of our computer centers, the floor waxing machine, when they're waxing the floor in the tape library, they got too close to the tapes, and the magnetism from the floor waxer was wiping out the tapes on the bottom shelf.
Oh.
Things like that. It's not necessarily sabotage, but just...
Okay.
Or if you have a fire, or if the roof caves in, or if the water leaks all over everything. Most of these companies have become so dependent on computers that if something happens to their computer center, they're done. Can't really operate. Yes?
I'm up here at Bowling at the breakfast office of computers. I have a master's degree in information systems, and I just worked 2 years as a forecast analyst for a plant manufacturer. And my job was, I was a liaison between the executives and the computer center. And I finally just got so frustrated that I quit. Because what happened to make a complex problem simple was that either the president's thought that the computer can give them everything, or when I gave them something, they didn't believe anything I gave them. And so it finally got so bad that you just gave up. To me, that's the biggest hassle working with computers is the people.
Uh-huh.
If I get rid of the people, the computer would work great. All my systems, information systems would work beautifully. But the people, that's such a terrible input to it that, I don't know. I think every computer man I ever talked to, that was his biggest headache, was trying to convince, especially in old school people that didn't know what a computer was, because they're the presidents right now. As they die out, it might change in the years, but that was really a problem.
Anything I said tonight you disagree with, or did I put it too strongly?
No, I don't know. I think, to me, computers are just a tool, and First of all, most people are already afraid of them, and they shouldn't be afraid of them. Once you, if you even study a little bit about them, you can see how, you know, how simple they really are, and how they, you know, how you really have control over them, and how everything you put into them. But people don't know that, you know, they think somehow it's bigger than both of us, and so they get afraid of it. And it's, it is, but you said, that point about the LA freeway, it was really important, because when I was developing my forecasts, I had to think of all these different variables, and whatever variable I put in, what weight I gave it, just subjectively, determined, you know, thousands of dollars on how we allocated our money. And it was just so arbitrary, it was really funny. But, you know, they said, well, somehow it came out of the computer, and the computer said it. All it was me telling the programmer to punch this in. It had nothing to do with anything.
People feel that if it's on a computer printout, it must be true.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, there's a justifiable fear, but I think what you're saying is it might be a misplaced fear. The fear ought to be in terms of the society that uses the computer.
You're right. Yes, it's the whole point. Worry about the people, not the machines.
In a larger perspective, the nature of mankind as he uses his tool. You know, that's pretty awesome.
Dave, you asked me, or maybe it was John, asked me today about the people that I work with. Are they church people? You know, do I have other... I got to think about this. And I think the people that I work with in the engineering department there, by and large, are at least average in their church participation and attendance. I can find one fellow I work closely with as the president of his congregation. Another fellow is chairman of the budget committee of the LCA Minnesota Synod. Many people have positions of some responsibility in their congregations. They're concerned people, I think.
Well, I think the one thing behind that question, I don't remember who was asking it, but obviously the guy who is making the chips or doing the technical work on however that's done, was a Christian commitment, say it doesn't really enter in too much into how that chip comes out, but given those in control of programming or setting up models or that whole kind of thing, their priorities and so on do come into play. Just kind of interesting, again, the whole question of how we use computers, in part is determined by our system of values.
I guess I would say, it seems to me that things have changed in as much as when computers first started, the programmers more or less ruled the world when they first got the computers. Were right there, but nobody really knew how to use them. And so for a long time, there was absolutely no check on the programmers because they were the first people, like in a new frontier, they were the first people there. And so there was people were, you know, embezzling money left and right, you know, just taking on a little extra fraction of the pennies and then putting in their secret accounts. Just because another programmer would know that, you know, what they were doing because it was so complex and they were in virgin territory. But now that's changed almost drastically. I think now there's so many checks and things that it's still possible in some sophisticated things that, you know, you call up on the phone and, you know, embezzle some money, but it's really changed a lot. The world has caught up to the newness of it, and it's changed a little bit, which
quite,
is good.
I haven't quite caught up yet, though, because last July, I think, it was a year ago, but anyway, it was the 1st of July, they were going to convert the major companies in the Twin Cities to electronic funds transfer, which meant that instead of getting a paycheck on Friday, the paycheck would be deposited in your bank automatically. Now, they're doing this with Social Security checks now, and it works okay. They were going to do it there in the Twin Cities with the companies and the individuals' paychecks, and it was all scheduled, we were all told about it, it was going to happen on this date, and it never happened, and nothing was ever said. And the only reason I could imagine is that someone discovered that the system really wasn't secure enough yet, and there were just too many potential ways in which funds could be shifted out of the proper place into someone's pocket. It's a very difficult thing. Computer security is an area that very little work has been done on. A lot has been done, but nothing much has been accomplished yet. How do you regulate who has access to these data banks?
Most of the time they have programmers that program in sections. That's the way they get around it now. So they put them together with some kind of security. So one programmer doesn't program the whole process.
That's kind of hard to have an overall view to what you mentioned, David, of our sense of values of what we're doing. There can be perfectly honest and people with a high moral sense and a high degree of integrity, but in the big system that he's working in, he really not only doesn't exert much control, but he might be in ignorance of the implications of what he's doing because he doesn't know the large picture. A lot of the social issues that I get involved in, when we get in a group of church people, they really didn't know. They thought it was great that highways are designed by computers. Isn't that fine? Didn't know that the environmental impact statement had anything to do with this. You know, there's no direct relationship, so they can read in the newspaper about something over here, and then go to their work the next morning and not realize that they are a part of the problem. It's awful hard to see the whole picture. And in the churches, how can they give the picture? I don't know. So that the congregation can be aware.
Do you got time to go into the 12 push buttons on telephones?
They're tied into these, the fact that today you can communicate with a computer using your push-button telephone. There's the 10 numbers and 2 extra buttons, and you can do whatever you want with the 2 extra buttons. Most of the computers, large computer installations, you can dial them up on a telephone. And in fact, a good many of our programmers carry a terminal home with them at night. It's easier to work with a computer at night than it is in the daytime because they're not so busy. And if you've got some programming to do and you can't get on the computer in the daytime, you take the terminal. They have these little, forget what the name is, but they're in an attaché case. There's a keyboard in there and a teletype-like machine that types out what the computer says, and a place to lay your telephone. You go home, you dial a computer number and lay the telephone in the cradle and proceed to talk to the computer from your home. And probably what will happen with the push-button telephones when they become general is that, for example, with a credit card check, you go into a store to buy something using a Bank of America card, and the store owner's got to call Bank of America card and verify that your number is good for this amount of purchase. And with a push-button telephone, he can just dial the number, and when he gets the signal from the other end, punch in your credit card number and the amount of the purchase, and use these extra 2 keys for end of message or some other control signal. And then the Bank of America card system, with an automatic voice response system that has a recorded voice, the way the information operators are on telephone exchanges many places now, it's not a person you're hearing, it's a recorded voice, can respond back as to whether this account number is okay or not. It's a tremendous problem for these credit card companies to handle the load at Christmas time, and they don't know what they're going to do in the next few years. This computer understanding or speech understanding project we've got, they almost gave us a contract to figure out if we couldn't somehow or other make it possible for them to have an automatic system for answering the telephones at Christmas time, because they can hardly hire enough people to handle the load. Every transaction that you make at a store where you charge it has to be phoned in and checked. And it's just a tremendous load. If they could do it by some automatic means, it would be great. Well, the push-button telephone gives them that means. The trouble is, not everybody has push-button telephones yet. But the 2 extra buttons are just can be used for control signals, anything you want.
Banks do that now. My bank, they sit there and I want to find out how much I have in my account, so instead of calling and talking to somebody, they just push my account number and it comes out with that recorded, evidently they have a voice that has every number, and they kind of put them together somehow and they say how much money you have.
You can buy these voice response systems at a telephone company in Minneapolis. When you dial a wrong number, the voice that comes back and says the number you dial is not in service is a recorded message. It comes out of a computer. And we build a a voice response system for the FAA for, they're experimenting with it. They did an experiment in Knoxville, Tennessee, and now they're working in Atlantic City with it, where it automatically talks to the pilots and tells them what the weather conditions are on the ground as they're coming in. The control tower operator could get too busy and not have time to tell the operator what's going on just at the instant as he's approaching the runway. For this system, it can give automatic advisories to the pilots based on input from the weather instruments or from the computer, tell them about other approaching traffic, so on. And it's based on recording all the possible words you want to use, storing them in the computer memory, not on a tape recording or in a phonograph record or something, but storing them in the computer memory as digital information, bits and pieces, little single bit signals, and then calling out the proper words at the proper time to make up the proper message to tell a particular pilot. Any other questions? Thanks for your listening. A couple of books here that are in the library. One is This Man and the Computer, which is worth reading. And then in the Scientific American Reader is an old article, 25 years old, on mathematical machines by Harry M. Davis, which talks about bits and these zeros and ones, the signal, no signal that I was talking about at the beginning. Gives you an idea of how that goes to make up information. So that's it.